RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for another Health Hacks Monday morning at RCR. And Dr. Glenn Davies from reversalnz.co.nz, who's cured over 150 people of type 2 diabetes. Wow, I should get a medal for that.
Well, that's very kind, but interestingly, I would say that I had just walked beside these people on their health journey.
Okay. Yeah.
The contribution I made is pretty minimal compared with the amount of effort that they had to put in. You know, my part's the easy bit. I'm just giving the resources and making the suggestion. It's the people that have done the hard work. So I would say they cured themselves.
All right, fair enough. Now that we've got that sorted, this is a really interesting topic on this Health Hacks. Informed consent. What are the key elements of informed consent, Glenn?
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, Paulo. This really came into my my current consciousness because as part of some of the compliance that we have to do in general practice, it's called foundation standards. I had to look at the Health and Disability Commissioner's site, the Code of Rights, and there were three parts to that, and one of the parts was informed consent. So I've just done the course on the Health and Disability Commissioner's site. And informed consent, so the key elements of informed consent is empowered autonomy, informed decision making, so disclosure of relevant information. It must be comprehensive and voluntariness. I didn't realize that was a word, but voluntariness, it must be voluntary. And the client must have competency. So those are the five key elements of informed consent. But I really wanted to focus on the one of voluntariness. So the definition of that is it must be free from coercion. The decision to consent or refuse must be made without pressure or coercion or undue influence from healthcare providers, researchers, or others. And it must be free from threats or manipulative tactics. It must be free from duress, including physical, psychological, or emotional pressure.
Okay. None of that applied in the time period that everyone is thinking of. None of it. That was totally violated.
Yes, and I would say that there definitely were violations of voluntariness. Geez, I'm using a lot of big words today, Paul.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that word either. I like it, voluntariness. But that's a major point. That whole concept of voluntariness in informed consent was thrown out the window, and they knew that they must have known they were throwing that out.
Yeah. We'll come to it after we've looked at the other areas of informed consent that may have been compromised. But the question that is raised is, are there occasions where it is reasonable to compromise informed consent? So I think that's the question which we'll spend most of the time discussing, if you're happy with that, Paul.
I can give you my answer. Never, never, ever, never. First of all, as a principle, it is a cornerstone principle in of itself. Second, she can't trust them. They lie. There you go.
Hey, well, let's expand on that a little bit further on, because I don't think it was only voluntariness that was compromised, because another key element is informed decision making. So all information about the treatment, including the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives, need to be offered. So your thoughts on whether the recent events met the criteria of informed decision making?
Not at all. I had personal experience. I think I've relayed that to you in previous program. I got called up, reminded to have a jab. I asked specifically, I'll be interested if you can get me to a level of informed consent. And, well, I've said what happened there, but they couldn't. She had, poor thing, no, in fact, don't get someone to call who doesn't know anything, you know, had no idea and had kind of made stuff up to try and persuade me. I knew that because I was already informed. So no, from my experience and other people I've spoken to, it was impossible to make an informed decision.
And that raises another question, Paul, around were the people who were employed to give the vaccines, the people on the ground, did they have adequate training to provide informed consent?
Did they aspirate?
So, yeah, I had this conversation recently with one of the key decision makers. They definitely looked into that, the science around that, and made the considered opinion that it was not necessary to instruct them to aspirate. So they made that decision based on a scientific assessment, whether the data they looked at was appropriate, et cetera, et cetera. But there was consideration given to that question.
Because it wasn't supposed to get past the arm muscle, remember?
Yeah, I do remember.
So how did it get past?
So indeed, and that might be perhaps a discussion for another Health Hacks possibly.
Okay, but you hear where I'm coming from. You know,
I do indeed.
Because you could easily be suspicious to say no aspiration because that's too much training. And when you've got, you know, Jesse Mulligan in the car park in Auckland giving away KFC to people through their windows for having them injected by celebrities, well, you know, you're going to train them in the art of, you know, giving people injections? No.
Yeah. And you brought up a really interesting extra issue, this idea of persuasion and financial incentives that must not constitute undue influence. Now, a $100 voucher for Pack and Save and a $100 KFC voucher for you and I suspect, Paul, would not necessarily constitute undue influence, but for a 14-year-old child, I think that would be a very strong incentive and possibly constitute undue influence. I don't know what you think.
Well, I do. And I think if it comes to that, you've lost all the arguments anyway, because that's treating, isn't it? That's the concept of treating. And that is to get over any downside doubts or anything, and it completely erodes probably all the principles. Maybe voluntariness isn't eroded because you're volunteering to take the treat for doing the thing. But I think that offering incentives like that is creepy. It really is.
So it's interesting when you look at the actual legislation, financial incentives are allowed, but they must be commensurate with the costs involved. So I interpret that to mean, for example, if you had to drive to a hospital to take part in the study, it would be reasonable to compensate somebody
fuel
for their fuel
and
costs,
time. Yeah, you know? Maybe.
But at what point does it constitute undue influences is the question. And I think for a 14-year-old, a $100 KFC voucher constitutes an inappropriate financial persuasion.
Inducement. Mm. What about Vaxathon? Remember that? That was trading on the great memories of telethons, which brought New Zealand together. I remember I was actually on a telethon once. I remember on the panel. Luckily, yes. I didn't have to shave anything off or anything for the money. But to have that sort of event, again, you know, it's, how do I describe that? It's so inappropriate.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, you can look at the statements, and then the interpretation comes into it. What what constitutes reasonable and what constitutes undue. That's the interpretive element of this.
And by that time, there was sufficient information to raise serious doubts that any person using logic would have, if they were intending to do something, would have probably paused at that point and wanted more information. And then they would have seen the mismatch between what they're being told by everybody. And because we were, New Zealand, I think, was in a unique position because we were kind of dragging the timeline. So other countries, like countries, had been through what we were about to go through, and we'd seen some of the outcomes of that. So that information was there, you know.
And that's this question of informed decision making. Was the information that was provided adequate for people to make an informed decision? And was that being constantly updated? Was it updated in a timely manner? And was it being transferred to the people who were required to give informed consent in a timely way? Those are all questions, I think.
And I would say, again, no. And remember also, the game changed. First of all, and I think Biden said it, and I think Jacinda Ardern said it, you take this, you won't get sick, you won't go to hospital, and you won't transmit it. Then, because we were dragging behind the timeline, we learnt before the mass rollout that it did transmit. You could get it, and you could still end up in hospital. And they kind of changed the messaging dynamically. They didn't say, hey, we're getting it wrong, we're stopping, or we're pausing. They doubled down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where I would think there are questions around the quality of the information that was given required to allow people to make an informed decision.
Okay, so people walked into thinking they were doing something that had been thought out, that was backed by science. They only wanted to help us. The government would never harm us. So what happens when all the principles of informed consent are violated so badly? What happens?
Yeah. Well, I think the question is there a time when it is okay to compromise these principles, which are in the New Zealand Code of Rights? Is it okay to compromise them for a greater good? Does the needs of the community and the benefit to the community outweigh individual autonomy? Is there a point where you can compromise individual rights for the greater good? And was this recent situation an example of that or not?
Well, I mean, it was basically a form of martial law in a way. I mean, it wasn't on the statutes, but all normal rights were kind of suspended. Mm-hmm. So my answer to that, again, would be it's never okay. It would have to be something so dire, you know, where imminent threat of multiple people dying, you know, like today or tomorrow. I can see. And that is a martial law situation, potentially. But yes, otherwise, it's, for me, I'd much rather go down than bend to that.
You know, the example where it is okay to compromise informed consent is you come across somebody in the street who's unconscious because of a serious health issue. You don't have to ask them, can I do CPR on you? That's clearly an occasion where it is okay. So you know, there are occasions.
No, good point.
Did this constitute it or not?
No.
And I would say, like, the first thing, was informed consent compromised? The answer is absolutely yes. In our conversation so far, you know, there's no doubt that informed consent was compromised in all of those areas that we've discussed. The next question, though, was it justified to do that? And, you know, at what point would it be justified? So the COVID-19 response did compromise informed consent, in my opinion, and I know in your opinion as well, because it was not free from coercion. All the relevant information was not given. But was it justified? Did the benefit to public health justify the clear compromise to the Code of Rights would be a question that I would ask.
And I think the answer to that is yes, because we can refuse forced medical intervention or treatment in our Bill of Rights. And that came out of an horrific experience in world history. And I guess the other thing, Glenn, is nothing was modified. As you found out more, the opposite seemed to happen, that this doubling down, this the intensity of persuasion became more. And anyone who had a voice against it, boy, I wish we'd listened to them, was shut down.
Yeah. And one of the key aspects of informed consent is that, or particularly in this issue of balancing the public health needs against the individual rights, is that public dialogue needs to be encouraged. And I would suggest that public dialogue was discouraged. So when we're looking at this question of public health versus individual rights, in order for it to be justified, there's five criteria that must be met. So autonomy needs to be honoured. Financial consequences cannot constitute undue influence. And transparency needs to be maintained. That's one of the key elements in justifying this decision. And transparency was not maintained. And you're aware of the Official Information Act, which disclosed that 11,005 Ministry of Health and DHB workers out of 60,500 received special circumstances exemptions. Yet very, very few individuals who applied for exemptions had those exemptions honoured. And one of the criteria is that exemptions need to be honoured. I tried over and over and over again many, many times to get exemptions for individuals who I felt had very, very strong justifications for exemption from the COVID-19 vaccine, and those were not granted. Then to find out that 11,005 DHB and Ministry of Health workers received exemptions, that was 13.67% of the workforce received exemptions for special circumstances. I find that doesn't meet the transparency requirement.
We need to know who those people are, actually, as part of transparency, because, you know, we've spoken to plenty of ex-health workforce people on this radio station, on this show, but on the station, who were thrown out. Yet there seems to have been a cohort in, that workforce that was given those exemptions. Who were they? Were they run-of-the-mill every day? No, I know, but this is the question. Who were they? Were they the top brass? Were they top surgeons? Were they managers? Were they rank and file? And why was it so crucial that they were able to get that? Here's a question for you, Glenn. Did you get rational explanations, reasoning coming back to you, explaining why these exemptions that you'd applied for, let's say on behalf of your patients, were not granted?
Not medical explanations. We received a letter signed by Ashley Bloomfelt to say that the exemption had not been granted, but not an explanation from a medical point of view of, you know, explaining the risks and the benefits and, you know, weighing that up and explaining why it was just a simple form letter.
Well, how could that be then? Because you're making that decision or that recommendation on the basis of your medical knowledge and your assessment of the individual. So it's the onus is surely on whoever denies it to come back and say, well, okay, I understand your reasons, but we'll deal with this point. That's why we, even saying no, who the hell do they think they are?
You know, and that didn't occur. And you're right, that did feel disrespectful in that the effort that was put into requesting the exemption was not returned by, you know, a medical discussion of the risks and benefits. So yes, that felt offensive.
Can I ask you a difficult, awkward question? You don't have to answer it, but I got to ask it because people will be thinking it. Do you have any knowledge, not even specifically from your patient group, any knowledge of an exemption application for a patient or a person that was denied and then they got in a very bad way? Do we know? As a result of taking it, having been denied it? Because if that's the case, I'm thinking of courtrooms, you know?
I don't have any personal experience of medical adverse consequence after an exemption being denied, but I certainly can think of multiple examples of social and emotional and psychological distress. For example, people having to leave the country because their visa was commensurate with them having employment. When they lost their employment, they had to return, in the example I'm thinking of, back to South Africa, to an unsafe environment in South Africa. The number of people who were unable to pay their mortgages and had to sell their houses, the number of people who are unable to support their family financially, you know, those are the consequences I can think of.
Why was ivermectin banned? That's the other question I've got, because surely in these situations, if you've got medications that seem to be effective and are safe, so if you took them anyway and they didn't work, it wouldn't really make any difference. Why were they banned, and why is it available now?
Yeah, so the first part of that is the emergency use authorization required that there were no alternative effective treatments, or if there were, then the manufacturers of the COVID-19 vaccines would have been required to go through the usual process that often takes 10 years. But the emergency use authorization allowed them to fast track the development and rollout of the vaccinations. I think that if ivermectin, for example, or hydroxychloroquine, for example, had been shown to be an effective treatment, it would have compromised the emergency use authorization.
Well, that just blows my mind.
Now, there has been a lot of scientific research done on ivermectin, for example, and there are many studies which suggest benefit, but equally many studies which show lack of benefit. And that's when it becomes very, very difficult, because then you have to go into the individual trials and you have to look at each individual trial and make an assessment of the robustness of that research, do a statistical analysis. You have to do that. You know, there's over 100 trials I'm aware of. You have to do that for all of them, and then you have to come to a conclusion. That takes more time than an individual clinician such as myself has to do.
Yeah.
And to then go into each study and actually look at its validity, it requires, you know, it's a researcher that has to do that, and I haven't been able to do it.
Well, when you're doing a national effort and you're printing 55 billion or whatever it was, then that's what you got to do. Too bad. Sorry. You got to do it. They went even further than that. They demonized it as a horse paste or something like that, horse, you know, worm paste or something. So they made it sound disgusting and dirty and below human consumption, let's say, on purpose. You see the pattern that is coming through here?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm uncertain from looking at the science how ivermectin alone goes, both as a preventer and as a treatment, and even as a treatment for long COVID or vaccine injury. But I don't think it was used in isolation, as the clinical trials do. It was used as part of a bigger response. You know, it often was associated with vitamin D, vitamin C.
Well, I had Dr. Peter McCullough on the show multiple times. Now, if you believe it, probably one of the most experienced cardiologists in the world. That's how he's promoted. He's certainly an incredible speaker. He has a mind like a computer. He can remember every study, attribute every author of that study. It blows my mind talking to him. He had a regimen early on that he was treating people with, which he claimed was very successful. You know, it was there, like you just mentioned before. It should be available. It's like if I don't have a headache and take a Panadol, it's not going to hurt me, right?
And the studies which I think have not been done or not been done to my knowledge is what was the impact of the using all of those interventions at one time. If ivermectin alone is not giving a statistical response, what does that combination of treatments do? And that's the study which I would like to see. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, which again is not robust enough science, but a lot of anecdotal evidence that using that combination of medications brings about, or medications and supplements brings about benefit.
Okay, well, you know, we're a bit down the track now. The other thing that I'm you're interviewing me. It's okay though. the other thing is, I've seen the spreadsheet, and I think I might have mentioned this before, of the vaccination centers, pharmacists, and all that who, you know, medical practices who did the injecting, and I know how much some of them were paid. So if you had a big medical practice with thousands in it, it was like lotto. Never underestimate the greed of people.
Yeah, it's another element to this informed consent discussion. Like, it's largely the discussion is focused on the individual, but is undue financial influence on the deliverer also an influence on informed consent, which I expect is part of the question that you're raising there?
Well, when I got called up, the experience I've related, I should have been smart enough to ask it. I wasn't, because it was all happening at once and thought that bit through. But part of the transparency should have been in this situation. If you want to put people up against the wall like this, you need to declare first off, by the way, we're getting $36 a dose, all right? So you're going to earn us $36. You know, even that would have had me suspicious, because then I can calculate, well, I know the medical practice that called me has about 3,000 in it, okay, for a particular area. Do the math.
Yeah. So Paul, I would sort of say, you know, more in a conclusion, that informed consent was compromised. It's been argued that compromise of the Code of Rights was justifiable for the greater public good. The questions, I think, are, is that true? And there's no black and white necessarily here, but was it justifiable? Was this compromise of informed consent justifiable? You're very clear in your opinion. The answer is no, and I'm not expressing an opinion, just asking a question. And if that discussion, I think, definitely should be happening, and I think it's now time that those discussions did happen. And if we conclude that there was too much compromise of informed consent, what could we have done better? And hopefully these are some of the questions that come out in the Royal Commission. You know, how could we have done better? And one of the ways that I think we could have done better is we should have honoured people's rights to these exemptions. You know, those should have been allowable based on individuals' values, individuals' health history, individuals' beliefs. And initially, we got the indication that these exemptions would be granted on that, you know, within that framework. And then subsequently, it became very, very hard line. You know, and initially I thought, oh, it's okay. Anyone that sort of has a justifiable reason, whether that's psychological, financial, physical will receive an exemption. And I was, you know, I wasn't a fan of mandating the vaccinations. I thought that was a step too far. But if the exemptions had been had been fairer, let's say, I think that would have probably been okay, but they weren't, you know, and I didn't receive a single exemption for people. You know, to me, that's where the system broke down. We, you know, the mandates were a step too far, true. But if the exemptions had been fair, I think we would have probably got around this. But I think with the exemptions being so, so strict, I think it just fell apart there, and the resentment and lack of trust that has been left behind, I think could have been mitigated or significantly diminished if we had not mandated the vaccination for healthcare workers, but secondly, and others, you know, and secondly, if we had allowed a looser exemption process where anyone who had a justifiable reason for exemption received it, I think, again, the loss of trust and the ill feeling, the trauma or the resentment that remains would have been mitigated.
This is a festering sore in our society. It's not going to go away. It's only going to get worse if it's not addressed. Tell me, I wonder, well, no, you can't tell me, but I wonder, was Ashley Bloomfield on that exemption list? How do we know? We should know. Yes or no? We want to know.
I don't know. And I'm not sure if I know that many of us want to know. I'm not sure if that's going to be particularly helpful to name the people or the organizations.
I'm sorry, Glenn. I'm sorry. It's too far gone. We have to know. Part of the healing has to be this transparency, because if he, as an example, using him, because he's the one sending back these refusals to you, if he got himself exempted, what the hell is going on there?
Yeah, and I suspect that it was the heads of department, and I think there's a real lack of integrity if that is the case, because did they then require their nursing staff or their house surgeons and their patients to have the vaccination, yet they didn't themselves, you know, like, integrity requires people to be upfront, doesn't it? And I have huge admiration for the people who looked at the data and decided to have the vaccination. I also have huge admiration for the people that looked at the data and decided not to, but I have massive contempt for those who pretended to have it but didn't. You know, that's where my anger and contempt is. No ill feeling for any of those first two groups. You know, good on you, well done. But that 11,005, I just have huge contempt. That's where my, as you say, festering anger sits. You know, that was wrong, unjustifiable, cowardly. I have contempt for that 11,005 colleagues, you know, colleagues of mine.
Mm. All right. I suppose if you're a top surgeon and you're saying, hey, I'm not going to work here if you're going to do this to me, they'd probably cave because you really need it. Maybe it worked like that.
And if they're, I don't know who it was, but if it was the heads of a surgical department, let's say, for example, in a teaching hospital, without a surgical department, that hospital would have to close, probably or largely, and the teaching aspects, the training of medical students, would have to cease. So I can see how they could easily put pressure on the government not to close a major hospital during a pandemic.
Then it becomes a class war.
It does, but, you know, the individual integrity, the integrity of those individuals not to stand up and say, yes, I'll have it, no, I won't, you know, that's where I feel resentment.
What about people recommending, I know I'm going on, but there's just questions coming straight into my head, people recommending it who were exempted?
Exactly. And hopefully there were none, but I suspect that there were.
All right. And last question. Last question. You've triggered me this morning. Last question. First, it was two shots, right? That's how it was initially sold. Two shots, simple. And I think there was even sort of like zippy little lines, you know, two shots for Christmas or what. I don't know. Can't remember. I know people are up to their number six now. That's not a vaccine.
No, you would hope that in a single or a very small number of interventions that immunity was achieved. You know, is there justifiable benefit if that benefit only lasts for 2 months? And I would argue clearly no. Hey, Paul, just to finish.
Yeah.
I think that every one of us, wherever we sat on these issues, whether we were a big fan of the lockdowns and the vaccines and the masks, or whether we argued strongly against them, wherever we have sat, I think everyone has experienced some degree of trauma around these issues. And whether that's been breakdown of relationships and families, bullying in the workforce, feeling uncomfortable walking into a medical centre, whatever it is, everyone has a degree of trauma. And trauma may be too strong a word for some people, but for many people it has been a trauma. I think for healing to occur, these issues need to be discussed, and people need to have the opportunity to express what they think, but also how they feel. So I think the time now is to listen to our neighbours, to our families, to our patients, to actually encourage them to speak about how they feel. And I think it's now a time to rebuild trust. You know, and you said for that trust to be rebuilt, we need transparency, and we need to acknowledge where we could have done better, where we perhaps made mistakes. I think the mandating of the vaccines was a mistake. I would love to see people say, in retrospect, we went too far. Perhaps it was justifiable, but in retrospect, we went too far. We compromised informed consent where it was not justifiable. And to say sorry, I think for the trust to be rebuilt, particularly in medicine, the Ministry of Health, Public Health, the people that made predictions of 10 times the amount of deaths that didn't occur, I think they need to be discussed. But then I think an apology is needed. And it takes courage to apologise, but I think we respect people who have the courage to apologise and say, I was doing my best, but I was wrong. And that's what I would like to see happen now. And I think the trust can only be rebuilt if people are able to acknowledge the areas where they went wrong. And I think the mandates was an area where we went wrong, and the degree of compromise of informed consent was another area where we went wrong.
All right. Well, that, I think, sums it up pretty well. Thank you, Glenn, again.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. I'm sorry I made you relive all that trauma. But,
no, I can. I've been through it enough.
I'm hoping hoping us having this conversation will encourage others to have conversations, irrespective of the outcome of those conversations. Let's just start talking about it and listening.
Yeah. We'll talk again soon, Glenn. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.